is now being recorded.
Actually, I have conference now on phone, so I can't.
You can come.
Well, that's extended the script.
Hi folks, this is Kim. I'm just checking in to see if everybody who's on the line was able to get the PowerPoint presentations okay.
I was, yep.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, this is Kim. I'm just checking to make certain that everybody was able to get to access the PowerPoint presentations.
Yep, no problem.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah,
great.
No problem.
Okay, that's great. Okay, so I'm just going to check in, and then we'll start right at 1, okay?
Sounds good.
They have this on the site, and in every place where there's a link. So,
hi, folks. Again, this is just Kim, just checking in as people start to sign in on the phone, just wanting to check to see if any of the participants are having problems accessing the PowerPoint presentations.
I just came on the line, Gary Templeton. Did you check in with you or?
I'm sorry?
My name's Gary Templeton.
We're not really checking in. We're just kind of like you kind of people just sign in. We're not taking people's numbers and names down.
I see. Okay.
But I'm just kind of checking to make sure because it's not a webinar, it's a teleconference. I just want to make certain that everybody on the line was able to access the PowerPoint that was on the website.
Right. That's the one to be downloaded.
Yep. So you've got the link to the PowerPoint?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you're good?
Yep.
So there's two presentations. The first one will be the one by the MMM Group Limited, and theirs is kind of green, okay?
That PowerPoint, it says presentations will be posted on the HCBD class website. Is that, do you click on that or what?
Yeah, if you've got the calendar invite in front of you, if you click on that link, it takes you to the page, and then you'll see that there's kind of two PowerPoints at the top of the page, and if you click on those, you can download, okay?
Great, okay. Thanks.
This is Paul Robinson speaking.
Hi.
And I printed out one. The first page says, implementing active transportation facilities in small communities. And it was about 40 pages. Is that the entire document, or is there another one to print?
There is that one is the first presentation, and the second presentation is by Vancouver, by Dale Bracewell, and it's about 150 pages. So if you've got access to a computer, it might be easier just to follow on the computer rather than trying to print it out.
Yeah. So that's the second one?
That's the second one. So that
okay,
one will
so
be
if
kind
I go
of...
on, if I, I'm on this Healthy Canada by Design class website now.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Vancouver retrofitting streets.
That's the one.
Okay.
Okay, so if you click on that, it's a mammoth document. It's I think it's more than 100 megabytes. So just watch it on your computer, but that's the second one, okay? So we're going to start with the other folks.
I'm opening it now, and it's just gone. It's showing the loading symbol, and it hasn't even got through a quarter of it yet.
Yeah, it takes a while to go on. Okay, so that's okay because that one's not going to start for a little while. But just so you know, so that's why we share them this way. You know, we're not doing a webinar; it's a teleconference, and we just ask people to follow along on the PowerPoints on their computer. Okay.
Okay.
So, folks, we're just waiting for everybody else. Like, we're giving 10 minutes so that people can sign on. We have 120 people signing on, and so we're just giving people time to get on. Our speakers are on the line. And as soon as I'm going to give a few more minutes, and then I'm going to mute all of your lines so that we can kind of cut out any background noise.
Okay, thank you.
Great.
Can I just ask what the first slide says to make sure we're in the right place, please?
It says implementing active transportation facilities in small communities.
Perfect, thank you.
And it's kind of green in coloring.
Yep.
Okay.
Good, thank you.
Any other questions about the PowerPoints?
No.
Okay. And so can I just get maybe just a really quick sense of how many people are on the phone? Maybe, I don't know how I do this with 120 people, but maybe just, maybe I won't even try and do that. I'll just give people a few more minutes, okay?
Or call out people's names.
So people who are just joining in, just a reminder, we've got two PowerPoint presentations on the website. The first one, the first presentation will be by MMM Group, and their presentation is titled Implementing Active Transportation Facilities in Small Communities. So that's the first presentation that we'll be doing today.
Hello.
Yes. Oh, no. So you're saying that? No.
Excuse me?
Okay, so I see. Yeah, okay.
Hello?
Hi, folks. We're just waiting for everybody to sign in. It's 120 people signing in, so we're giving 10 minutes for everybody to sign in. So in terms of the setup for today, the first presentation, there's two on the website. The first presentation will be the one implementing active transportation facilities in small communities. It's kind of green in coloring on the front page, and that'll be the first presentation. The second one will be in the second hour. That's by Dale Bracewell. Okay, is everybody okay? Everybody's doing okay kind of accessing the PowerPoint? Any problems?
Excuse me? Hello?
Hi, Sandy.
Okay, so, hi.
Hi, Hi it's Megan.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. That second presentation was actually really large, so we weren't able to even download it or print it off, though.
Okay. I wouldn't recommend printing it off, but if you could download it, that would be great. And it does take a long time.
Okay.
But it does take a few minutes to download. And what we could do is maybe you could download it during the questions, between the two presentations.
Good.
Yeah, the second one is 150 pages long, and it's mammoth. It It's really huge, okay? It's got great visuals, so if people can access, it's great. It's probably best not to print it out. Okay, so I think what I'm going to do, well, people, if everybody, unless there's any more questions from people signing in.
Hello?
Yep.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, any questions for before I mute people?
Hello?
Excuse me.
You say we're supposed to sign in. How do you like to sign in?
Can you hear me?
I'm sorry, pardon me?
You said we're supposed to sign in. How do we actually sign in?
You don't actually sign in. It's just you just phone in. So you're here. We're not signing you in.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep. Good.
Okay.
Hello.
I don't need this.
Hello.
Hello.
Excuse me. Do we need to sign into the website or we just
print out
the material?
No. You've actually accessed to sign into the website. You just follow the link on the calendar invitation.
So we just print the material, that's what we want, and listen to the phone, or we need to sign it physically to the website?
So on the calendar invite that you got, there was a link to our website. If you click that link, it takes you to the page. The top two presentations, like you'll see the two presentations, those are the presentations that will be given today. The first one that's on the top is the one that's going first. The second one is will be the second presentation. The second one is very long. It's 150 pages, so don't print it. Just kind of download it, okay?
Okay, so we don't need to actually sign in for
no.
the presentation to the website. We just
no,
take
you're
the
actually,
material out of it. That's
no,
it.
If you hit the link, it takes you to an open page on the website.
Yeah, I got the material already.
Okay. So you're in the teleconference now, so you're good.
Okay then.
Okay, so this is it. So folks, I'm going to one last time for anybody who has any questions, and then I'm going to kind of get things going. Okay, so I'm going to mute the lines. I'm going to mute everybody's lines except our speakers. So if you have any questions, my email address is on the calendar invite you got, so you can send me a note through the meeting. I'll be checking my emails just to see if there's any questions or concerns. So right now I'm going to mute everybody, so you don't need to touch your phones. I'll do that for you, and then I'll unmute them. And so I'm just going to mute everybody now so that we have, like, get rid of the background noise.
The conference is now in silent mode.
Okay, Dave, Jay, and Claire, are you still there?
We're here.
Yes.
Okay, great. Now, right now, are you guys on conference phone?
Yes, we're on a conference phone.
Okay, it is a little bit, it's a little bit of kind of an echo, just so you know, if it's possible for you when you're presenting to speak one at a time, that might be a little easier and clearer. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can't take it off conference, but we'll speak one at a time. Is that okay?
Okay, that's fine. Okay, so folks, just everybody on the phone. Now, I've muted everybody, and I will unmute you. I'll just kind of just introduce people and set them up. So first of all, there's going to be two presentations today. They're both on our website. The very first presentation will be the one that's kind of green in coloring on the front page called Implementing Active Transportation Facilities in Small Communities. And just to introduce myself, I'm Kim Parada, and I work for the Heart and Stroke Foundation, and I'm the Knowledge Translation Coordinator for the Healthy Canada by Design Initiative, which is funded by the Canadian Partnership Against Cancer. And we originally organize this event for our members, all the Healthy Canada by Design members, which is about 40 members. And what's happened is because of the interest in these presentations today, we've opened them up to a number of the members from some of our partner organizations. So we actually have about 30 people from the Canadian Institute of Transportation Engineers, another 30 from the Canadian from members of the Canadian Institute of Planners, and then we have about 20 people from Heart and Stroke Foundation, and then I'd say about 30 people from the Healthy Canada by Design, many of whom are health professionals working in public health authorities across the country. So that's kind of the general makeup of the audience today, and we're really pleased to have people here. And in terms of the format for the day, there's two presentations by four speakers. presenters. So the first presentation is going to be by Dave McLaughlin, Jay Cranstone, and Claire Basinski, who are with the MMM Group Limited. And we've asked them to focus their presentation on how to retrofit streets and neighborhoods in small and mid-sized communities, with a particular focus on Ontario, just because we'd heard that they'd done some very good work in Ontario. So they're going to be going first, and they're going to provide a little bit more of an introduction for themselves when they get started. In terms of the overall presentation, the format of the day, they're going to be speaking for about a half an hour. They're going to give you some case studies, and then we're going to open for questions and answers. And then we're going to introduce our second presentation and our speaker, Dale Bracewell, who is with the City of Vancouver. And again, when he's finished, we'll unmute the phones again. I just want to let everybody know that the whole meeting is being recorded, and then we will post the recording on our website to share with other members. And let me see if there's anything else that people need to know. Just that I will be muting and unmuting the phone, so you don't have to worry about doing anything to your phone. And I think with that, then I'll let Dave kind of start things off. So again, it's on the green presentation that is named Implementing Active Transportation Facilities in Small Communities. Dave, I'll hand it over to you.
Thanks, Kim, and thank you everybody for joining us today on this class presentation series. You should have a copy of our presentation in front of you. It would be helpful. If you don't, you can just close your eyes and imagine a perfect world for active transportation. In the bottom of each of our slides, there's a number, and we'll just keep referring to our slide numbers as we go through our presentation. So on slide two, our topic today, as already noted by Kim, is implementing active transportation plans and facilities in small communities. And just a quick overview of what we're going to talk about in the next 45 minutes is a little bit about ourselves, of course. We're going to talk about what active transportation is, who are some of the users. We're going to talk a little bit about political support and our experience and how important that is. We're going to talk about benefits, challenges, tailoring approaches for smaller communities using some examples here in Ontario. We're going to describe some of the elements of the kind of work we do, and then we're going to talk about three case studies, one in Wellington County and focus in on some of the small communities, Elgin, St. Thomas, and then Leamington, Ontario. And then we'll wrap up with some lessons learned. So we have three presenters today. I'm going to start us off and then pass you on to my colleague Claire, and then Jay, and then back to Claire. So if you turn to page three, you'll see a few pictures of who we are. So you can imagine I'm Dave McLaughlin. I'm a project manager here at MMM, and our lead, our active transportation practice. Jay Cranstone is an active transportation and trail specialist and landscape architect. And Claire is a project planner who specializes in active transportation and public engagement, and is really interested in the health side benefits associated with active transportation and helps us follow studies. So if you move to slide four, this image is really just to talk about what is active transportation. We thought it would be helpful, at least for our presentation, if everyone sort of had the same kind of vision. So, and we've introduced active recreation into this, which is the top left, only because a lot of people use active transportation facilities also for recreation. So it's really a piece of the pie. So, you know, active transportation is used for exercise and recreation as well. We wanted to include that. People use AT facilities for journeys to and from work or school. I think we all know that. Trips to and from shops and visiting friends and going to work. And it's a key component when we think about active transportation. It's not one thing. It's sort of similar to complete streets, which we'll talk about a little bit later, that it's sort of a, you know, even in active transportation, there's sort of a multi-use, multimodal approach that needs to be thought of when you're doing these types of studies, especially for small communities. So slide five, who are the users? You know, we're primarily focused on pedestrians and cyclists because they tend to be the design users that we plan and design our facilities for. But of course, there are other users, joggers and runners and people who are out with their kids walking. And so I just wanted to walk through sort of our view of the users. So for utilitarian users, you know, we're really talking about people who use facilities for day-to-day transportation. You know, some of them may use it year-round. A lot of them have reasonably good mobility skills, even though there's a lot in the press here in Ontario, and I'm sure across the country, about the whole issue about people who ride their bikes or walk, and people who drive their cars, and that's an ongoing debate, but it's, I think, you know, getting itself worked out. Recreational users, again, we talked about people who, you know, they cycle, they may go use bike lanes to go to the mall on weekends or in the evenings, and we're very interested in targeting that group and getting more people out to use their bikes or to walk and maybe combine walking with public transit as part of their trip. And then there are touring cyclists, people who are traveling larger distances as part of a vacation. Perhaps they're visiting a community and they're bringing their bike, and that's part of their decision as you know, going on vacation, is that they want to experience a location not just by their car, but you know, on foot or by bike. And that's increasingly important here. In Ontario, it's gaining great momentum. The Ministry of Transportation and the province are very keen on developing a provincial scale cycling network here that connects to the various provinces on both sides and down into the United States, and really links us in. And you know, a lot of us are looking at the great success of La Route Verte in Quebec as sort of a model to work with. The chart that's on this slide is really, you know, a chart, many of you have seen it, is really a horizontal bar graph. It's the same thing. It's from Roger Geller in the United States in Portland, and it talks about the various types of cyclists. And we're really interested in the interested but concerned, and the enthused and confident, but especially the interested but concerned. So when our firm works in municipalities, including small communities, we're not really designing systems for experienced road cyclists. We're designing for people who go out occasionally, who are interested in doing it more, but really aren't comfortable right now. They don't feel like they have the skill, or they're concerned about riding with traffic. And we're trying to design systems and market them to really reach out to these people, because this is where we'll have a significant change in modal split. And really, from a health perspective, this is the area where we can really see some measurable change if we can reach into this target group. Finally, before I pass on to Claire, the next slide really just talks about support nationally at the federal level, but you know, at the provincial level, with the Canadian Institute of Planners and Transport Canada, the Canadian Automobile Association, especially here in Ontario, and I'm sure across the country, has really emerged as a big supporter of active transportation and cycling. The Heart and Stroke Foundation, Canadian Institute of Transportationeers, and the Transportation Association of Canada, who's actually having their conference right now in Winnipeg. And in Ontario, for us, and this will be the same, I'm sure, for all provinces and territories, you know, our Ministry of Transportation, Tourism, Culture and Sport, and Public Health and Long-Term Care, and our police, and our local planners, and all the other various professional organizations. And then down to the municipal level, in terms of active transportation, you know, it's being captured in active transportation master and trail plans and official plans and even new strategic plans, and in much of the work that the various district health units in our province are doing, even down to school boards and all the way down to the development industry. I'm sure you've seen developments in your neighborhood where you'll see signs up that are promoting a new residential community, and those communities really tack into quality of life, and you'll see cycling and pedestrian and trails and a lot of those images. So, you know, Canada is really moving forward, and it's an exciting time to be involved in active transportation. I'm going to pass now over to Claire, who's going to take you through the next set of slides. Claire?
Thank you. So we're now on the slide of Southern Ontario with all the stars. As Kim mentioned, we are going to do a bit of an Ontario focus, as that's where a lot of our work focuses on, not all of it, but a good majority of it. And this slide just illustrates some findings that we gathered from a study we recently completed with the Ministry of Transportation for Ontario. They did an inventory of communities throughout the province who had undertaken plans, developed policies, explored initiatives to do with active transportation, and we consolidated that information, and from this we got a really good snapshot of what's going on in Southern Ontario. And from this we can really conclude that there are a lot of different things going on, active transportation related plans, infrastructure, also active living and healthy lifestyle promotion, and they're being rolled out all over Southern Ontario through large, small communities. Doesn't really matter what the scale is. There are many different municipal, regional, provincial initiatives that are going on right now. And so for the next slide, we just wanted to highlight a bit about the benefits that are associated with increased levels of active transportation, but also things that really help to help these communities realize what sort of benefits can happen at a personal level for their for the people who live within their communities, but also at a community level as well. We've highlighted six benefits that we tend to focus on typically. The first is community health and safety. By implementing a number of different facilities or initiatives, you tend to see an increased level and number of opportunities for physical activities. And increased levels of activity definitely contribute to healthy and active lifestyles, decreases in the number of long-term health issues, including heart disease. As we were mentioning before, the Heart and Stroke Foundation is a huge supporter and a group that does a number of different research initiatives. It also makes communities more livable, and when communities are more livable, it gives residents a sense of safety and a sense of comfort. And we found that to increase as people get engaged in their community and as active transportation becomes the forefront for that. The second is transportation as a whole. By increasing the amount of cycling and walking through your community, it can help to increase the number of residents and visitors and the modes of transportation that they can use. They not only feel like they can use their car to get around, but feel like there's a number of different modes and can integrate those modes, as Dave mentioned before. It reduces the dependency on auto travel, and in many cases for trips that are less than 7 kilometers, people can actually use active modes and it can be faster than getting into your car. So it's increasingly becoming a more viable option for your day-to-day or even recreational travel. The third is economic and tourism. As I mentioned before, it also has to do with decreasing the amount of healthcare costs and the amount of impact on our economy because of the amount of people who are experiencing significant healthcare issues. It also significantly supports local tourism and investment in the community by bringing people into the community, spending money, but also enjoying themselves in a healthy and active way, increasing the amount of jobs and local investment, as I mentioned before, because of these tourism benefits, as well as sort of a side benefit that we've started to see come forward. The fourth is asset management, which by increasing the amount of active transportation and cycling and walking activities, it can actually provide a means to appreciate your surroundings, appreciate those tourist destinations and natural and cultural heritage resources that are found throughout your communities. And it's an additional way to highlight them. The fifth is the environmental impact. Obviously, active transportation is a very energy efficient and non-polluting way to explore your community and go about your day-to-day activities. Resource conservation and large amounts of energy savings are only some of the benefits that can be realized. And it has been shown that even a 1% shift to cycling or active modes of transportation can significantly reduce fuel consumption, which is something that we're all very aware of these days. And lastly, community building. By engaging in active forms of transportation, it brings people together. It brings communities together. It builds community spirit and really fosters stewardship, not between the residents, but between stakeholders, interest groups, as well as, in many cases, municipal employees or staff from different interest groups and organizations. So now that we've highlighted some of the benefits, we did want to mention some of the challenges that we've seen from some of the plans that we've done at the local community level and the smaller communities. We have we've found that even though they are not the same for each project, and in many cases they're very different, there are three different areas that they can be grouped into that we tend to see a trend in. The first one are the physical challenges. Sometimes it's hard to understand the context-sensitive areas and the challenges dealing with the constraints that you can see within your municipality. There's a lack of continuity or connectivity, which can create significant barriers for people who are trying to engage in active transportation. And we just have two samples here of graphics that we think are pretty funny, and it is something to laugh at, but this does happen, and this actually prevents people from becoming engaged in walking and cycling and can stop people from getting involved. The second are the political challenges that can come to a head, trying to maintain the ongoing commitment and trying to get buy-in from councils and stakeholders, trying to ensure that the processes that are happening at the different local levels of government and that the through the different departments at municipalities are in line and that they're all on board with the same initiatives. So the political challenges can tend to create significant barriers as well. And lastly, momentum and outreach. It's excellent when a community can develop a master plan and has successfully done so and adopted it, but it's about taking that further and ensuring that what's included in that plan is actually implemented. And having that promotion and education and a branding concept which continues and builds upon the successes that have been realized when developing the plan. So ensuring that there is momentum and the momentum drives implementation forward. So as part of these three challenge areas, I'm just moving to slide 10 now. We realize that there has to be a tailored approach. There is a general process that we go through to develop an active transportation or related master plan. However, for smaller communities, there really needs to be different key elements that are tailored to those communities. And we've highlighted 8 of these elements, which are illustrated on this slide. And we're going to go into a bit more detail of them, but I'm just going to go over a high level right now. The first one is identifying champions. The second is responding to public demand. Then using a complete streets approach to designing your streets in your municipality and integrating active transportation into those design concepts. Building on existing guidelines at the provincial level, at the municipal level, even internationally in best practices. Identifying context-sensitive solutions that take into consideration the characteristics that are specific to the area that you're trying to design for. Leveraging economies of scale, looking at the different funding alternatives and partnership alternatives that can be realized. Coordinating with other capital works projects, looking at what's being identified for other transportation plans and trying to coordinate and work with those different projects to get the active transportation facilities on the ground. And lastly, as I mentioned before, providing ongoing promotion and education and making sure that people know how to use the facilities. So some more details about these different elements. The first slide on slide 11, we've broken it out into the identifying champions. And ways you can do that is engaging individuals from external agencies. We found that it can be very successful, and for some of our projects, we have the health units or tourism organizations leading these master plans. They have the ability to see it from an outside level, able to coordinate the different initiatives between the different departments at the municipal level and within the government, and they know how to coordinate and to collaborate with these different groups. Seeking buy-in from the public as well as municipal council early in the process, it's important that the public stakeholders as well as council are aware of the initiatives going on and can help to promote and help to move the master plan forward and move the projects forward. And having their buy-in is important to seeing the master plans adopted, but also seeing them implemented. Facilitating ongoing commitment with the public and with council and ensuring that people are committed to seeing the master plan implemented. Responding to public demand, we have found that consultation with a wide range of users is important, so understanding those user groups and their wants and needs. Promoting at local destinations and meeting points has been a key success for us. Going to those community centers, going to those arenas, going to those places where we're bringing the consultation and the ideas to the people so they don't have to come and seek it out from us, and we increase the awareness throughout the community. Targeting all sectors of the population, consultation approaches need to be tailored to youth, to seniors, and to those different groups and their wants and needs. On slide 12, we look at building on existing design guidelines, reviewing the existing municipal standards, and looking at best practices, and looking at what those standards are, and staying informed. We have OTM Book 18 that's coming out right now, and that'll be a great standard guideline for municipalities throughout Ontario. There's also a number of international best practices that are excellent resources for municipalities to use. identifying context-sensitive solutions, so undertaking detailed field investigation to understand what your characteristics are and assessing and documenting the unique characteristics that would require a more context-sensitive solution and maybe a different solution than what the standard is. Engaging design specialists and research, designing best practices and alternatives so that you understand the different best practices that are out there and try and incorporate those into those more context-sensitive areas. And using a complete streets approach. Dave mentioned this, and on slide 14, we mentioned that balancing the wants and needs of cyclists, motorists, and pedestrians is a key way to do that, incorporating all of those different design features to respond to those wants and needs is essential to creating an environment that is supportive of all of those user groups. Ensuring that accessibility is at the forefront of the design and designing for people of all ages and abilities, and engaging transportation, municipal, and land use planners in the design process, and understanding that all of these elements are essential to developing a streetscape and a street design that works for all user groups. On slide 15, we cover off leveraging economies of scale, so working with other municipalities and the provincial and federal governments to come up with funding models and mechanisms to get the plan implemented. Establishing partnerships between the different stakeholders and interest groups, and exploring different grant programs and partnership opportunities with local organizations, looking at local service clubs or Share the Road organization, and having them involved and help to promote and see these implementation projects through. Coordinating with other capital works projects, strategically phasing and implementing strategies, ensuring that communication and collaboration is successfully undertaken between different internal departments, and updating capital works budgets annually, so making sure that this flexible tool can be integrated into the different budgeting changes and opportunities that happen at the municipal level on a yearly basis. And providing ongoing promotion and education. So in addition to actually having the infrastructure on the ground, it's essential to promote the benefits that active transportation can provide to your community as well as to individuals. Educating people on how to use the system. Some people feel like they can't actually use the facility because they don't know how to, and that's a huge barrier. Targeting people, again, of all ages and abilities. There's different education and promotion techniques that can be used for these different groups. It takes different messaging to get the word across to different groups of users and ages of people. And implementing simple but effective initiatives. It doesn't have to be an elaborate strategy that's used to promote the system. It can be something simple like some sort of branding strategy or a poster which just increases awareness and makes people aware that there's a continuous project going on and it's an initiative that is community-wide. So I'm going to hand it over to my colleague Jay Cranstone, who will focus on our first case study.
Great. Thanks, Claire. So the next part of the presentation, we're going to go through three different case studies. I'm going to look at the first two, and then I'm going to pass it back over to Dave McLaughlin, and he'll discuss the third one. The first case study is Wellington County, Ontario. And what we've tried to do for each of these, and as Claire pointed out earlier on in the presentation, we do see similar challenges in all of these projects, and they can be somewhat grouped into those three categories, if you will. What we've tried to do with our case studies is draw out some of those different challenges from these projects, hoping that we might be able to send you away with a few things that you could try in your municipalities to move active transportation along. So Wellington County, Ontario, the goal for this project or the goal for the master plan is quite simple. It was to create opportunities throughout the county for active recreation and active transportation. The project began in 2011 and was completed in September of 2012. A couple of the key objectives to the master plan were to examine the current conditions for active transportation and recommend a network of active transportation facilities. And along with that, create recommendations for education and promotion, and to identify some of the costs for priorities as part of the phased action plan for the master plan. Wanted to point out that that there was an active transportation steering committee involved, and we really owe a lot to the steering committees that help us out with our projects, because they really are very, very important to coordinating things and to getting the word out, bringing the right people to meet with us and so on. So they really helped out. The committee really helped out a lot with this project. And the other consideration here is that it was run both at a county level and a local municipal level. And at the county level, we were able to create a framework, and at the local level, it accompanies a local master plan as well. So sort of two plans in one, if you will. So moving on to slide number 17, a little bit of geography and a little bit about Wellington County. There's a map on the screen there. The county, it's a fairly large area, over 2,500 kilometers squared. It's bordered by Huron County, Gray, and Perth counties to the north and to the east, and Waterloo region to the west, Hamilton and Halton region to the south. So in the bottom right-hand corner of your screen is really where the Greater Toronto Hamilton area is, and to the sides and to the north, the top part of the screen, it really is quite a rural area. The county includes seven separate municipalities plus the city of Guelph, and the city of Guelph is lodged in the center of Wellington County, but it's geographically, although it's geographically part of the county, it's a separate political and administrative body. Population in the county, this is not including the city of Guelph, population in the local municipalities range from 7,000 to about 26,000. And the county has a number of interesting destinations, conservation areas, existing trail systems, some very significant existing trails, and some programs as well that really play into tourism and promotion of green active work in the county. Moving on to slide number 18. There are three, going back to the three themes. So here are the three themes once again. We have the physical challenge, or the geography, the political challenges, and the promotion and outreach. So in terms of the physical challenge, what we wanted to draw out here was the size of the County of Wellington and how to develop a network at a very broad scale. From the political point of view, getting buy-in from local councils and getting buy-in from local staff on implementing the plan is a challenge, and it's not something that is overcome right away. It's something that you start to work on through the planning process, and you've got to continue to work on throughout the entire implementation. And then in terms of promotion and outreach, it's about understanding, for Wellington County, it's about understanding where we are at the beginning and building upon that. So what we mean here is really understanding at a baseline level the infrastructure, the programs, and also the use. And this becomes a very important tool for reporting back about how the program is going overall. On to slide number 19. How did the study leverage economies of scale? Well, a couple of key things here. There was commitment, as I pointed out a few moments ago. There's commitment at the county level as well as at the local level, a partnership in terms of funding, a partnership in terms of developing the plan, and this was also joined in big part by the Wellington Dufferin Guelph Public Health, who had a key role in not only bringing the plan together, but bringing the people together and bringing the steering committee together. Collaborating with other capital works projects, so we were able to get feedback from community services departments and engineering departments where information was available on capital works programs, budgets, and timelines, so that could be factored into determining which priorities might take place first, second, and third in terms of the implementation of the plan. And all of this is to help coordinate a proposed phasing at both the county and the local municipal level. In terms of identifying champions, the plan engaged local and municipal county staff as well as local stakeholders through the AT Advisory Committee, and as I pointed out a moment ago, there was a real key coordination and lead role by the Wellington Dufferin Public Health through the In Motion campaign. Slide number 20, identifying the context-sensitive solution. So as part of the inventory and analysis process, there were some key areas where additional design considerations were required, And a part of this involved undertaking a review of best practices for projects of a similar scope and scale. As far as responding to the public demand, there is public demand, which we were able to uncover as a part of the process. And through two public information centers at local events, as well as stakeholder workshops through the process, engaging a number of individuals and interested agencies and so on, it was clear that there was public demand. And through taking the public information centers to places where festivals and things were happening, it was much easier to reach out to people. And preparing various materials for engaging the public, online questionnaire, hard copy questionnaire, really helped to bring in information about the project. Providing ongoing promotion and outreach. So by establishing a communication strategy early on and focusing those efforts, as well as reviewing best practices for health and promotion and outreach programs for other municipalities in Ontario, we were able to bring some of those ideas to the committee for consideration. Moving on to slide number 21, overcoming the physical challenges. So these are sort of the three key areas that we wanted to bring forward. So the physical challenge in Wellington County is the size. The map shows an outlay of the county with the various townships, and to the bottom right of the map is basically where the Greater Toronto and Hamilton area lies. And the issue here is how do we lay out a proposed network that serves the destinations, that serves the various communities, and also makes the key connections, places where cyclists and active transportation users want to be. And we found that a successful way to do this is to develop a set of consistent route selection criteria and apply these in each of the different communities. It's got to be balanced, it's got to be tailored to the individual communities, but by looking back to these route selection criteria, it's a sounding board. It's a way to examine the decisions that you've made, both at the time that the master plan is undertaken, but in the future when changes to the network are being contemplated. And one thing that we will point out about rural communities with some urban centers in them is that there needs to be a higher density, obviously, of active transportation facilities in the urban areas with some key connectors into the rural areas and connecting those communities. Slide 22, overcoming the political challenges. I will say right up front that this is a work in progress. It's something that you can't expect to walk in and have everybody on board right away and stay on board. It's all about strategically engaging county and local decision makers at all levels and helping them understand the process, helping them, walking them through a number of elements and having sessions at different stages in the project. We've found that having one early on to understand what the issues are and then coming back later to try to discuss how some of those issues can be resolved. And one of the challenges that we found in some of the smaller rural areas is that we know that engineering folks, parks and recreation folks, are really busy in their jobs, and they don't have time to necessarily to devote to these singular projects all the time. And there's some apprehension at the engineering level to implement some of the facilities in the rural areas. In the case of Ontario, it's partly because of some interesting wording in the Highway Traffic Act at the moment. But one of the things that we were able to do here was to sit down with the county engineers and just walk them through their issues and concerns and try to help them out just to understand, really as a way to start to move forward. And perhaps an additional strategy to consider here, it wasn't conducted as a part of this study, but to develop and undertake a training session to educate staff who are going to be implementing the plan. So this is after the plan is finished, going back to them, and basically it's a training session on how to use some of the guidelines, how to apply some of those guidelines, and implement the facilities. On slide 23, the challenge of overcoming promotion and outreach challenges. Something interesting that's been developed in Wellington County is the notion of performance measures. So through the plan, there were a total of 27 performance measures suggested, including things like the number of kilometers built, the number of users on the active transportation network, the number of people within a trailhead or an active transportation facility, as measures to track the success of the plan and be able to report to councils and so on how successful the plan is being undertaken. So here it was about collecting a baseline of information for trail and active transportation facilities, and one of the things that the local committee has had some great success there was actually with engaging a master's research student to develop a measurement program for performance measures and actually go out and collect some data as part of a summer work term. So that really does become their baseline for understanding where active transportation is at, who's using it, which facilities are being used, and it also has led to an investment in some technology to gather additional data. And here it's trail counters, placing those out at key trail locations and actually taking physical counts of who's out there. Again, it's data that will be useful. Moving on to our second case study, Elgin St. Thomas. So the dates here, May 2012 to December 2012. Some similar goals here, developing a network of facilities, identifying opportunities for implementation at a conceptual level, and providing and engaging residents throughout the Elgin St. Thomas area. Again, this study was led by key staff at Elgin St. Thomas Public Health, and really the success of the study is owed a lot to them. A wide range of engagement tools, such as an online questionnaire, were used. And wanted to point out this one really is, it's not a full master plan, it's a strategy. It was and we called it an initiative, so it really was a first step towards active transportation. And this might be something that is of interest to smaller municipalities. Rather than trying to go to the full master plan level as a first step, perhaps there is a stepping stone that you can take. Just a little bit about the geography of Elgin St. Thomas. It's located I'm on slide number 25. It's located on the north shore of Lake Erie. It's a long, narrow municipality. It has about 1,800 kilometers squared in terms of its area. It's bordered by Chatham-Kent to the west, Middlesex-Oxford County to the north, and Norfolk County to the east. Geographically, Windsor-Detroit are off to the left-hand side of the screen. Niagara and Buffalo are on the right-hand side of the screen, and the City of London is up towards the top of the map. It, like Wellington County, includes six municipalities, plus it's got the City of St. Thomas, which is it's physically part of the county, but it's its own government and own administrative body. One of the unique aspects about Elgin County is that it has over 90 kilometers of coastline on Lake Erie, very desirable from a tourism point of view, from a longer distance touring cycling point of view, lots of really interesting port towns along the way. So on to slide number 26. Physical challenges. So here what we've tried to draw out is the challenge of trying to determine what to implement first. In terms of the political challenge, we're going to talk a little bit about identifying a champion to lead the development of the initiative. And in terms of promotion and outreach, we just wanted to highlight how do you maintain momentum gained during the development of the AT initiative, during the master planning process itself. How did the study build on existing design guidelines? It includes a consolidation and a review of existing design guidelines and best practices. And also, because of the timing of this study, we were able to integrate some of the concepts that were being developed for Ontario Traffic Manual 18, which Dave spoke about a few moments ago. So it really does bring together some of the latest design guidelines for the development of active transportation facilities. In terms of responding to public demand, there was a PC at a Public Information Center at a local event, and materials were posted through a number of different media to engage the local public. And this also included a lot of effort by our client team to do things like stand in lines and hand out questionnaires at kids' movie nights, at some of the the homeless shelters, and a number of other venues that we just wouldn't be able to do as a consulting group just because of the time involved and the money involved. So, you know, really, really great way to piggyback on some local expertise and some local effort. In terms of providing ongoing promotion and outreach, so there was an education and encouragement and communication strategy developed early on in the project, and this was used to promote active transportation benefits to the public all the way through the project, and is still being used today as the plan is working into its next stages. It considered a complete streets approach, so the idea is to try to design for all user groups, both in the rural and the urban areas. And in terms of identifying champions, again, this is really, really key in these smaller municipalities, engaging local staff and the citizens at large. And in this case, it was led by the Elgin St. Thomas Public Health and a lot of local support. So in terms of the three challenge areas, the first one, trying to understand how to overcome the physical challenge. And the idea here was trying to understand what to implement first. And we noted that that through some local work, they had previously implemented some share the road signs on one key connection, a fairly busy connection between St. Thomas, which is the largest urban center in the municipality, and Port Stanley, which is a very desirable waterfront community. So there's a lot of traffic between those two areas and a lot of desire for cyclists to move north to south. So the logical extension of that is to look at extending that Share the Road program on some other key routes. Recently, the Lake Erie Waterfront Trail route was designated through the municipality. So one of the next steps may be to look at where to place Share the Road signs throughout that route and a couple of others. And really what this starts to do is it starts to get the message out there, it starts to increase awareness, and it helps to increase and connect key linkages. Overcoming the political challenge. So here it's about identifying that key partner to help lead the development and carry it on to the next step. And there was a lot, as I pointed out, there was a lot of consultation done with this project, a lot beyond what we could do as consultants. So, you know, real key that you might want to, in your own municipality, look to bringing on board. Let's move on to slide number 31, and that is overcoming the promotion and outreach challenges. So here we really wanted to focus on how do you keep that momentum after the planning part is done, after the energy from the consultation has drifted away and the plan is entering the implementation stages. And one of the successes that they've had here is being able to leverage what was done during the consultation and maintain that energy and momentum and actually develop some very interesting programs that are seeing the word get out and keeping people encouraged. I wanted to point out that through an online questionnaire, we had over 700 responses during the development of the plan, which is a pretty high number for a community of this size. And that energy was continued on through programs such as the Active Elgin program, which is a central hub for active transportation information in the county, the development of a cycling and trail map, the creation of an active transportation committee, the Citizens for Active Transportation, and in the bottom left-hand corner of slide 31, something that is quite unique that we learned about through this process. They've actually partnered with a local school. It's a local vocational school that's more trade-oriented, and they're using the students to develop and create, develop and build, actually, their bicycle racks. So it's a win-win that the bicycle racks are being designed and built locally, but it's also supporting education of young students who are heading towards perhaps a trade career. So I want to turn it over to Dave now, and he's going to talk about the last case study.
Thanks, Jay. So we've got about 4 or 5 minutes left, probably end up at 50 minutes. So I'm going to go through our last case study, which is Leamington, Ontario. So this case study really focuses on a corridor in a small to medium community. So you know, our objectives with this study, by the way, this study is still underway. So we haven't reported to council or the public, so just keep that in mind. But the objective is to implement a context-sensitive type of design solution, recognizing that it's a constrained corridor. There's not a lot of appetite to move the utilities in the corridor, but we still need to figure out how to accommodate pedestrians and cyclists. So if you look at the study approach, this is sort of a much more of a detailed feasibility exercise beyond a master plan. And we're looking at existing characteristics, developing some design alternatives, going out in the field and confirming what we think the alternatives should be, evaluating them, and then doing a functional design of what we think would be the preferred. So on slide 33, just to give you some perspective, Essex County is sort of at the far, I guess, southwest end of Ontario. It's right up against the American border. Leamington is the area shaded in green, which is one of the municipalities in this county. It has a population just over 28,000. This county recently completed a countywide active transportation master plan, which is a key component that we'll talk about a little bit later. And all of the municipalities have sort of partnered in terms of a common implementation strategy. Next slide, looking at physical political momentum. On the physical side, as I already noted, it was a very constrained corridor. It used to be a ministry highway. It was uploaded to the county and local municipality. Different sections. It's a connecting link. It's an important link between urban areas in the county. So we were trying to come up with a solution, again, that accommodates cyclists and pedestrians while minimizing costs. On the political side, the master plan was really helpful in that it set the tone and it identified this as a likely solution, and there was significant consultation across the county and in the various local municipalities during this study. And so that really paved the way towards, looking at a specific design and to move it forward to implementation. And, the key thing at the end of the day is, how much is this going to cost? What do we have to implement it? And does local council and the public really feel that this is what they want to do now? And that's part of our job as consultants, is to help the municipality down that road. On slide 35, just looking at some of the images at the bottom gives you a bit of an appreciation of what we're talking about here. So our particular corridor, which is about 1.8 kilometers, is located on the edge of Leamington in the urban area. It's got a mix of agricultural and single-family homes on large lots. There is established cycling traffic. There's a large number of migrant workers who live and work in this area and use bicycles to travel. Most of them don't have driver's licenses. And this is a very important element of this particular study. This route would be part of the Lake Erie Waterfront Trail that connects to the waterfront trail that goes around Lake Ontario. And the speed limit on the road varies from 60 to 80 kilometers an hour. So if you look at 36, we looked at a number of alternatives to address the physical challenges here. The first one was basically to try to pave the area in the boulevard beyond the existing mountable curb and to do our best to do that. So we're seeking sort of a 1.5 to 2 meter asphalt space. We can't have a sidewalk and a bike facility. So it's going to be a context sensitive design solution where we're providing a narrow space and both will have to share it. And in this area, given sort of the suburban nature, it likely is an appropriate solution, and those that we have talked to so far all seem to agree. And we really want to try to get the migrant workers who are cycling on this road a little bit of space just to get them off the road. So alternative two is the same kind of, it's the same alternative. The only difference is when we go in and add the asphalt, there's an opportunity to rip out the mountable curb and just replace it. And we were talking about economies of scale and a complete streets approach. And here's an opportunity to look at that curb and say, well, it's near the end of its life. Maybe we should replace it at the same time. It helps in a constructability perspective too. Alternative three on page 37, same street now. Here we looked at an option of, can we reduce the width of the road a little bit if we're going to yank out the curb anyways and shift it in to get a little bit more space on the boulevard. It's a great solution, but because this is an urbanized road, there are catch basins and leads, and even, the cost to pull out the curb is one thing, but to physically shift it, 250 mils or even half a meter, you have to move the infrastructure. You have to put in catch basin leads, and it really adds a lot of cost to the project, and, you have to question whether adding you know, a quarter meter on the boulevard is worth the cost. And that's part of this assessment, this study that we're looking at. Alternative four, we looked at, well, how about if we put a barrier curve in instead of a mountable curve? So so a barrier curve, you know, is not a bad solution. The challenge is, because if any of you know this area, it's flat as a pancake. And the barrier curve is actually slightly higher than a mountable curve. So we introduce drainage issues on adjacent properties if we have this curve. And it's difficult to lower the elevation, the vertical elevation of the roadway. So from a design point of view, even though it would be a great solution to have a barrier curve and side inlet, and then catch basins, and then have a little bit more space on the boulevard, it's got other challenges with that solution that probably mean it's not going to be the preferred solution at the end of the day. So next, go to the next slide, 38. This just talks a little bit about the physical challenges. Some of these I think I've already touched on. So, you know, we're looking for a spatial or physical separation from motor vehicles for both pedestrians and cyclists. One of the early alternatives was a suggestion by someone that perhaps we remove the curb and make this a rural cross-section road again and have a wider paved shoulder. The challenge is that it presents drainage issues. There are no ditches today. We'd have to introduce ditches, and by introducing ditches, we impact utilities, and also we impact adjacent property owners. So those are all considerations that we have to consider when we go through this. The operating space, you know, we're seeking to provide a minimum 1.2 meter operating space for pedestrians and cyclists. That works for wheelchairs as well. We do want an additional clear zone of any physical obstruction. I'd already talked about maintenance, so we'll just flip to slide 39. The land requirement issue, you know, we really want to minimize any need for adjacent land or impacting adjacent properties. I'm sure you all are aware, if you're involved in this type of business, you know, these ideas look great on paper, but when people see that it's going to impact their driveway, or they've got, you know, a wall on their along their property line that's going to be impacted, or a tree, you know, it becomes real for everyone, and it becomes real for us. So we try to avoid that at all costs. We want to come up with design solutions that benefit the design users, but minimizes the impact in terms of cost, but also impact to adjacent properties. I talked slightly on constructability. You know, the level of effort required to implement is very important. Sometimes complex projects seem to be the most exciting, but they become so complex and costly that they never get implemented. So you have to think about that too. And in small communities, this is really important. You know, they have limited resources. They're trying to come up with a solution that is appropriate and practical, that they can afford, that works towards, you know, the goals they have. It may not be the perfect design solution, but, you know, it's a context-sensitive solution and one that's practical, and we have to work with them to come up with something that we think improves safety but still meets their needs. And then cost. Cost is critical. Everything we do, you know, is really important. When we talked about complete streets earlier, we were talking about, you know, trying to think about a road corridor, and if you're going to go in and do some work, is there anything else that should be done at the same time, because you probably will have to do it anyways? When you go to tender on a contract, if you add in the cost of replacing the curb, perhaps putting in bike-friendly catch basins, maybe even resurfacing the road, yes, it costs some more money, but when you go through one tender to one contractor, the overall cost to get all those things done is, at the end of the day, cheaper than if you did it separately. So that's a consideration that, that municipalities have to think about. So just moving on to the next slide, sort of overcoming, we're on slide 40 now, overcoming the promotion and outreach challenges. Sort of confirming the alternatives, this is where we are now. So we've come up with alternatives, we've assessed them in the field, and we're pretty convinced that a solution is to add the asphalt behind the mountable curb, and if possible, and if they have budget, to replace the mountable curb at the same time. We think the cost to shift in the curbs at this time for that a small width of benefit is probably not an appropriate solution, and given the location and the context, that this is probably best solution, but again, that will be up for council and the public to decide at the end of the day. The picture that's on slide 40 is actually one lot along this entire corridor actually did this very thing. They paved their section of the boulevard, and I suspect it's probably in part because, you know, that section where the grass is, it never really looks that good. It just gets a lot of wear and tear and debris, and it's messy. So that's another advantage of sort of a clean line along the road. From a maintenance perspective, it really improves things. So that's the end of that case study. I'm just going to pass it back to Claire for our last slide, sort of as a wrap-up, and then we're going to take questions. Claire?
Yes, thank you. So as Dave said, this is a bit of a wrap-up, and we just wanted to highlight some lessons learned, and a lot of them come from these studies that we've looked at right now, but also from a number of other studies that we've done, and tend to respond to those different challenges. So the first one, seeking partnerships at all levels of government where possible, building on existing partnerships, enhancing relationships with agencies or groups that you're already engaged with. Keeping the public engaged, maintaining that momentum that has already been created through stakeholder and public engagement through the master plan studies and continuing that as the plan is implemented. Building the base case, highlighting the benefits and establishing an understanding of the individual and community benefits and letting the public as well as members of council and other key partners know about those benefits that can be realized. Preparing implementation tools, looking at annual priorities and identifying a set of tools to facilitate implementation, whether or not it's an organization chart about roles and responsibilities or using GIS as a flexible tracking tool to track implementation. Coming up with those tools so people know how to actually implement the initiative. Leveraging investment, so working with different levels of government, different agencies to come up with creative funding solutions to ensure that there's sustainable funding and ongoing money put towards these types of initiatives. Identifying a champion, as we said, for many of our projects, coming up with one individual or a group who can see the project through to implementation and be that one point person to facilitate the next steps. Applying a complete streets approach. Yes, we're talking about active transportation, but we're also talking about a range of different users and how to balance those users in a realistic and creative way in our different municipal environments and considering those groups when designing streetscapes. And finally, establishing ongoing promotion and outreach activities, starting with simple initiatives, as we mentioned before, and building on those, building on what has already been done and not trying to reinvent the wheel, but coming up with something that's creative and appealing to members of the public as well as our political representatives to get people on board for many of these projects and these initiatives. So I'm going to pass it on to Dave.
So Kim, thank you very much. On behalf of Jay, Claire, and I, we thank you for the opportunity to present today, and we've left all 5 seconds for questions. So over to you, Kim.
Hi, folks. I'm just going to unmute everybody, and I'll just say to people right now that we're probably only going to have about 5 minutes for questions, so maybe people could think about that while I'm unmuting you. Just if you've got, maybe if there's one pivotal question, I'd also just like to point out if anybody wants to send their question to me, again, you have my email address is on the calendar invite. If you want to send it to me, and I'll either ask it now or perhaps at the end of Dale's presentation, we'll come back to it. So I'm just going to unmute the phones now.
Is now in talk mode.
Okay, so, okay, you guys, so everybody, we're open, and as I say, I think we've only got time for maybe 2, maybe 3 questions, and so would anybody like to ask a question?
I wondered if the case studies were able to track an increase in cycling, whether it was for commuting or recreation, as they implemented these plans.
Dave McLaughlin. So I think, first of all, these studies are fairly new. It's a great question. All these master plans, we suggest that they do annual updates where they go out and see what they're seeing from implementation. These particular municipalities don't have that yet. Leamington's not complete, and the other two are probably, you know, 2 or 3 years old. Jay?
I just would point out that in Wellington County, as I noted, they were able to do that through a summer contract with a university students, so it was really, they were using that to establish a baseline. Because the, you know, the studies only go for a fairly short period of time, we're not necessarily able to, you know, to establish those kinds of numbers, especially when you're dealing with large municipalities, small urban areas, large rural areas.
Okay. Next.
Thank you.
Can I ask a couple questions about, you know, talk about bicycle paths, and I find the biggest problem with bicycle paths is mixed use and mixed speed. And is there any way, what it is, you get the, let's say, the sport recreation versus the tour or even the just somebody out for the Sunday ride, the difference is be like 30 or more kilometers an hour difference.
Hi, folks. Can I just point out that we're totally unmuted right now, so can you just be careful of the background noise in your offices, okay? Everybody's unmuted right now. And so did you catch that question, Dave?
Yeah, I think so. So, you know, in areas where there's high demand, and we can think of a number of locations here, very often we'll have parallel facilities. We'll have a multi-use recreational facility on the side of the corridor, and we'll have on-road bike lanes as well. It's always an issue when you have, you know, different, a mix of uses and people operating bikes at different speeds, people with their dogs on a trail, you know, walking their children or with a baby carriage. And it's really about context. You need to think about where you are today as a community and where you will be in the next 10 to 15 years that this facility is intended to serve. Our experience has been, you know, people understand multi-use trails when you put a little yellow line down the middle that they operate it in the same way that, you know, when you drive a car on the road, that you stay to the right, you enjoy yourself, you're careful about your dog and everything else that crosses the yellow line. And if you're a cyclist coming up on someone, you wait until there's a safe gap to pass someone, then you move to the left and you pass them. So, but on very high volume corridors or along waterfronts and things like that, you absolutely need to come with additional facilities.
Well, I think you're still working in an urban context here, right? In our community, there's two things. One, you get up on the road to go, you know, to go on to a training mode run. You get run off the road by the cars because they figure you should be on the bike path.
Right. Well, you know, in rural communities, we're really, especially in Ontario, there's a huge push to provide paved shoulders on almost all of our primary rural roads. And there's a big momentum in some municipalities anyways to start to implement that. There's also other road safety benefits to having that space. Not all roads can accommodate it. They weren't initially designed. So in part, that provides a little bit more space for the hardcore cyclists who might be on the road and prefer to be on the road because of, you know, they want to be traveling at a greater rate of speed. I'm not sure if that answers your question entirely. Again, it depends on the location and the characteristics. I think maybe if you want to send me an email, be pleased to try to respond to your specific case.
No, I'm just... reality here.
Hi, folks. I'm going to stop us there because I want to get headed into the presentation from Dale. But what I'll suggest is I'm going to mute everybody again because there's a lot of background noise. And then what I'll suggest is that people send their questions to me and we'll add them to the end of Dale's presentation. And so my email address, just so people know, is kperopta@hsf.ca. So I'm going to mute us again. I'm going to mute all of you.
Conference is now in silent mode.
And Dale, can I just confirm that you are there?
Good morning.
Okay, and so Dale, I'm just going to introduce you. So folks, what I suggest if you have additional questions, and I'm sorry that it was so short, I think that this is a really big topic and it was really hard for people to keep to the kind of the time limit we were hoping, but we'll bring some of those questions back at the very end. But right now we've got Dale Braithwell, and Dale is an engineer with a master's degree in transportation. He has 14 years of experience working on transportation. And he was appointed the manager of active transportation for Vancouver in 2010. And his presentation is the monster presentation that's 150 slides. And so I hope people have been able to access it. And Dale, I'm going to pass it over to you.
Hey, thanks, Kim. And good morning or good afternoon, I guess, if you're in a different or more easterly time zone. Really appreciate the invite and keen to participate. I'm actually not just an engineer, but I am a believer. I'm a believer that the future of healthy cities, healthy and happy people is us, transportation engineers, planners, working with health professionals that will be key, not the only, but key change agents and partners. So let's keep the dialogue going after we're done this teleconference and whatever questions come in. So, you know, I guess moving up in scale from the rural to slightly urban to the very urban, you can see that the number of slides and the megabytes of slides has increased. But I guess my goal is, and almost in one sense, to have kind of one large pekakucha for you. Lots of visual pictures of how we're actually realizing walking and cycling in Vancouver. And so even in this title slide, we're trying to, this is a title slide that we use for our most recent active transportation corridor. It's children, it's seniors, it's walking, it's cycling, and it's fun and delightful if you look at the little kid's backpack. But moving on to the next slide, just to make sure everyone's under the context. So I work at the City of Vancouver, so we're over 600,000 in our population. We have the downtown Vancouver and of course, big sports facilities and the metropolitan core. But the context is, of course, we are one municipality amongst many in what is the Metro Vancouver region of over 2.2 million. So I'm going to start with actually showing you the goals. This will be the next slide of Transportation 2040. And so the next slide shows you three major goals that we have. Is our transportation plan actually is not just about, okay, good for the environment and yes, reducing greenhouse gases and good for the planet is important, but if we don't have a transportation plan that supports businesses, then we don't have a plan that's helping move our economy. And of course, where we fit in terms of the health, of course, people, healthy citizens in a safe, accessible, and vibrant city. And so all of these are important. And then in the next slide, you'll see that what we did when we created the plan, we actually had workshops related to each of these other themes of our plan. And so you can see health and safety in there. And it was really important because what we did is we didn't have a walking and cycling workshop. We actually had a safety forum for all of our public and stakeholders. And what you had was, advocates for active transportation sitting next to our trucking association, next to businesses. And so these were kind of the additional lenses of our of developing our transportation plan. Moving forward, just a quick slide there on trends and targets. And then to the first slide of the trends, you see on the next slide, 2008, we actually at 40%. So 40% of Vancouver's trips today are by walking, cycling, and transit. And then the next slide shows you that our target for 2020 is to be at 50%, that at least half of all our trips will be on foot, bike, or transit. And so by 2020, we're expecting 25% of Vancouver's trip to be by walking and cycling. By reaching out another 20 years, on the next slide, you can see in 2040 that we're headed towards two-thirds of all trips, walking, cycling, or transit, where approximately one-third would be walking and cycling. And I think it's important to note that often big urban cities, it seems that when you're moving ahead on walking and cycling, it's an attack on the car, it's Carmageddon, it's all those things, the war on the car. And we note that, you know, for us, vehicle volumes we expect more or less to stay the same or slightly decline. And they're an important part of the transportation, but what we're all needing to get ready for is a substantial amount of growth. And so that growth needs to be accommodated by walking and cycling or transit in the years ahead. So the next slide is, I guess, emphasizing, and it was one of the questions, you know, how are you doing? Like, do you have any more walking and cycling? And I'll get to the specifically active modes, but overall, we were pleased to be able to report back to our decision makers, mayor and council, that we are trending towards hitting our shorter term target of 2020. So in 2011, we saw that we actually have 44% walking, cycling, and transit. And so that's good news and shows progress. I think it's important for all of us to keep getting the metrics and the data that helps justify or, you know, help the decision makers know that what we're asking them to do is ultimately good for our cities. So the next slide notes the other major target for us, which is a safety target, and it's regarding zero fatalities. The next slide will show you decades worth of transportation fatalities, and so at least we've noted since the 70s, we've seen a positive trend towards declining fatalities, but each one is one too many, and it's about the efforts that we do in engineering and here in planning and working with partners to move towards really that zero target in the years ahead. Next slide, though, shows our recent walking trends, and so again, the importance of being able to report out, you know, how are we doing? We've invested in public realm for walking, we've invested in new curb ramps, rehabbing sidewalks. So we're pleased to report out to our council that, you know, we've seen approximately, you know, 50,000 new walking trips. We're over 300,000 citywide, and we've seen a 20% increase even in the 3-year period we reported out. And these are 24-hour day citywide trips for walking. But also important is the next slide showing, you know, walking safety. And so accounting for the increase in walking trips and collision rates, and collisions here are defined as what would be a vehicle and a pedestrian collision, because we have only access to that as a kind of consistent annual database. But from an exposure perspective, we're able to say from a safety, it's gotten safer to walk in Vancouver over the last 3 years. The collision rates with vehicles and pedestrians has decreased. On the other page of active, cycling, so the next slide, we're showing you cycling trends, and again, another substantial increase on the cycling. In fact, in this case, over 40% increase over a three-year period, and so it's actually our fastest growing mode within the city of Vancouver for the last 3 years. And then again, next slide, similarly, what we're seeing is what people describe as that safety in numbers effect. So as people get used to, see more, and sometimes themselves or a person who cycles, that you're getting an overall safety effect. So we've got a huge increase in the number of cycling trips, but an overall collision rate that is declining, you know, indicating that, you know, while over time we'll actually have more collisions because we have more people biking and then more collisions happening, but the amount of exposure and safety rate is on a positive trend. So mostly high-level directions with the exception of walking and cycling, just kind of cover off how the plan's comprehensive. And how that's important, I think, is to note that you, even if you're developing an active transportation plan, making sure you're thinking of vehicles and goods and emergency services and, of course, working with your land use planners. So, of course, as you have good density and have ability for people to make shorter trips, that helps them more easily be able to take walking and cycling trips. And so we're really keen here in Vancouver about a very interesting public realm and having buildings that really support the walking and the cycling and the staying that goes in between those journeys. I'm sorry, I've already flipped off to a slide that says design buildings, but I'm already now flipping to a walking slide that says make walking safe, convenient, and delightful. And so that's our vision, and that in addition, we want to support a vibrant public life. And so this is kind of, you know, as we look towards European cities that have been doing this for longer, and walking is not just kind of a mode of transportation, but part of the way that you socially connect. So the next slide is showing you Hornby Street in Vancouver. We've got seniors walking. We've got our separated bike lane and a wonderful public realm with a double row of street trees. And so thinking about these types of streets as we build out more in Vancouver. The next slide is actually showing you one of our bridges. It crosses what we call False Creek, a bit of an inlet. And it's actually a leftover from the 1950s. Essentially, there's eight lanes, four in each direction, and we cannot, with the intersections on both ends, ever get enough vehicles to actually use that amount of space. So through your large planning processes in your major urban cities, encourage you to throw out big ideas. And so you go through the next slide, and you see how we're proposed here, a greenway, essentially taking only two of the eight lanes, but providing the opportunity for views, and providing for kind of comfortable, safe walking across what would otherwise be a bit of hostile, kind of highway-oriented bridge left over from 50 years ago in terms of its time and its design. The next slide just shows you just one of many curb bulges that we encourage community gardeners. And so you're taking a good thing, a pedestrian bulge, shortening crossing distance, making it a greater thing, having community members participate and getting into places where there's oftentimes they don't have an ability to garden. And then the next slide showing you a traffic circle. So many traffic circles are along our bikeways, and again, opportunity for community gardeners. These are volunteers, letting them, you know, play in the sandbox and have opportunity to engage. And actually, you can see this one here barely, but it's actually got a tree in the middle of the traffic circle as well. Pedestrian wayfinding, so this is something fairly new. We implemented these wayfinding standards right before the Olympics, but we're just in the process of kind of updating them with some much more urban type of view, where when you look at the map, it's looking exactly in the direction that you would think it would, and re-updating all those kiosks. The next slide, though, comes back to vibrant public streets. We actually have a streets activities team at the city, and they work with community partners to do things like this, where streets get converted into public spaces, And we're learning from other cities as we do this, but more and more, this is, I think, about how you make, you know, healthy citizens and feel a part of their community. And we do this on, this is our high street of Robson Street, the next slide, where we've got these, you know, this wooden parklet. San Francisco, by the way, is doing fantastic things on this, and we're still in the early days, but this is one of our examples that we'd like to showcase. And, you know, we're taking away, you know, good revenue parking to create more public space. It's open for all. It's not just for the adjacent businesses. You can use it as a sidewalk, or you can stay a while and enjoy a bit of your destination. The next slide is just, again, showing you, mostly these are summertime activations, but one of our kind of main transit streets, we actually reroute buses away so we can create more walking and cycling opportunities. This is one on Granville Street with movable furniture. And then the next one is on Robson Street, further down from the parklet example, but creating some beachfront here in Vancouver in the middle of our downtown. So again, all sorts of ways, and we have a great team working on this here in Vancouver. Next one's giving you our cycling vision, very similar to walking in terms of the safe, convenient, comfortable, but also fun. And the big thing is, and the earlier presentation touched on this, that who are we designing for? And it's for people of all ages and abilities. And I think the thing that I'd like to highlight that's important for other cities to think of is it's one to have it as an idea, but we now actually have council policy that this is what we, my team, are supposed to be doing. And so myself and my team, we're accountable to going to council on any designs, and I'll show you some examples now, but to say this has been designed for children, has been designed for new cyclists, has been designed for seniors, the interested and concerned, and that's kind of the accountability that we like, because it allows us to sort of look at what was here on the next slide, a before environment with a painted bike lane, and then what we've done recently is separated bike lane, and really setting apart, well, what does it mean to be more comfortable and convenient? I won't get into all the details about how we kind of prioritize our bike network. That could be a whole other webinar teleconference, but just gives you an idea. And we are focused a lot, though, on where we already have ridership and where the new ridership will come, and not trying to invest throughout the city equally. And so I'd say that's kind of the biggest point that I'd like to make on this slide. The other is, though, not forgetting the other important things that is at the destination, secure parking. So we've got one example here of a bike corral, again, taking away a parking space to provide convenient bike parking right outside a coffee shop where there was high demand for bike parking. And now I'm getting into some infrastructure examples for you. So this is Dunsmuir Street. It was the first downtown separated bike lane that we had done. It's a two-way facility. We used the green paint at the intersections, and this used to have either a parking lane or travel lane that we reallocated to be able to do this. There are special bike signals now along this corridor. And then this was the next one is our broad bridge, which was the kind of introduction of our separated bike lanes into downtown. But what we like about this photo, of course, is the children and their parents biking across it. And that's exactly what we hope to see. And we saw actually a threefold increase of children on our separated bike lane after a couple of years. But again, really being conscious of families and thinking of all ages and abilities, you know, being able to use, in this case, a local street bikeway, one of our more popular ones, east-west, just outside of the downtown. And then doing, in terms of our toolkit, on our local street bikeways, which tend to be, of course, streets parallel to arterials, but low-volume streets, and doing techniques like this, which essentially say, you know, it's a bikeway, and people who cycle, you please keep continuing going on your journey, but for vehicles, which are still allowed on the street, now you'll need to turn right and use one of the other many streets available for vehicles. More often than not, hopefully, we'll be doing more of these where we'll actually kind of have mini active transportation corridors. So this is a street that's for walking or cycling, but gives a connection where you can enjoy a bit of place and not have any cars between yourselves in terms of sharing space. And, of course, lots of opportunity for other public realm. But it's not always possible to review vehicle volumes and turning movements. And so in this case, we really needed to have a vehicle in one lane, but that gave us then an opportunity to create one-way cycle tracks. This is the slide that says local street bikeway at 10th Avenue at Canby. And the next slide, so again, going back to, you know, measuring the outcomes that you hope to be seeing, and research is really good about saying that if you look at your proportion of girls and women, whether it's walking or cycling, but that helps you because it's an indicator of the quality and the safety of your city's infrastructure. So we did that, and what we were able to tell council, so looking at the next slide, you'll see it says closing the cycling gender gap. On Hornby Street, when we had a painted bike lane, this would be not separation, we had 28% proportion of girls and women. The next slide shows that 1 year later, when we had a separated bike lane introduced, we already saw an increase in terms of more girls, more women. And then 2 years later, we were able to report out that now we've seen a substantial increase from where it was as a painted bike lane. And then our citywide average is 41%. And so it gives you an idea that now in the downtown with separated bike lanes, we're kind of approaching what's comfortable throughout the rest of the city. The other is then to, you know, learn from and benchmarking against the other great cycling cities. And so we were pleased to note that, you know, we're have a higher percentage of girls and women, you know, than Portland or San Francisco, other West Coast urban cities that we like to talk to and benchmark and learn from. So the next set of slides is going to do my best explanation of kind of, well, what does it mean then, Dale, as an engineer, planner, working in active transportation to really design for all ages and ability. And there are a lot of factors, and I think MMA did a great job in their case studies giving you, you know, what those might be. What we found as kind of the main two are the traffic volume and traffic speed. So just, you know, clicking on the next slide, you'll see in a green circle that essentially if we have low enough volumes and low enough traffic speeds, well, that is designing for all ages and ability. People can share the street, everyone's kind of happy and everyone's going slow and people looking out for each other. The next slide, though, notes that with the exception within that area that, you know, at arterial crossings, definitely think we should be doing something else there, whether that's markings or signals. Well, of course, not all streets are low volume, low speed. So then on the next slide, you'll see a new green kind of further up the vertical and the horizontal axis. And then on the next slide, you'll see traffic calming. So what that means is if we have streets and we're trying to introduce more, you know, walking and cycling, the key here is then, well, how do we bring the volumes down? You know, and I'll mention and I'll note an example where we went from a two-way street to a one-way street because that essentially brought the volumes down 50%. Or how do we introduce speed humps, raise crosswalks, other types of measures that would reduce the speed. And then on the next slide, you'll see this big yellow circle, because now maybe we're on a street like Hornby that I mentioned. It's an arterial street. It's going to continue to have 13,000 vehicles a day. So you'll see in the next slide the word separation. So kind of know this is a bit simplistic, but it gives you an idea that, well, don't always push against the tide. There are places that cars and vehicles and emergency trucks and fire vehicles need to go, and so in those cases, let's look at separation. And interestingly enough, on the next slide, there's a bunch of words that says COMOX. That's the greenway that we just completed. It actually used each part of this kind of design toolkit. And so the answer for us is not that it's separated bike lanes everywhere, and it's not that it's traffic calming everywhere, and it's not that we need to always find streets that have low volumes. It ends up being a combination, and the key, again, is making sure we're doing designing for all ages and ability in each part of the network. The next slide is a slide kind of showing a continuum of less comfortable to more comfortable. And the other is, and it was mentioned as context-sensitive design, for us it's kind of more about, well, again, maybe with the challenge of politics in mind and funding constraints, you know, how do you kind of move along the designing for all ages and ability as a spectrum? And so it doesn't mean that it has to be all or nothing. And so we've got examples that, and one I'll show you where we've kind of moved from a painted bike lane to a parking buffered bike lane. And that simply became an opportunity. And so it's recognizing that the network build out of all age and ability will take some time. And we want to continually move there and be accountable to that. But we don't need to have it perfect every time we're evolving a project. Just to round out the transportation plan in itself very quickly, of course, increasing capacity and frequency of transit is really important to complement walking and cycling. And again, making sure that as you're doing your active transportation, you are thinking, I mean, you know, you will always get the pushback of, you know, lost parking or reduced access or, you know, even good concerns about the driveways that will exist along your walking or cycling facility. And so making sure you're true to thinking of the vehicle lens. And then goods and services, as I mentioned, you know, a plan that, you know, is good for Vancouver, it has to support the economy. And I know that's similar elsewhere. And, of course, working with your emergency response providers. But the interesting thing about goods movement is it comes in different scales, and we're a port city, so, of course, we've got trucks and rail to think about. But we've just got our kind of first cycling goods movement provider in working in our downtown, and that's been successful for our last couple of years. But the one I'm really interested to share is working with our emergency services. And so we broke down what used to be a typical paradigm where, like many other urban cities, you know, that fire is usually the first responder sooner than police or ambulance. You know, they'll say, well, we need 6 meters of road space for vehicles so that, you know, we could pass a car or pass opposing traffic. What we did with a separated bike lane is we broke into new territory by recommending and saying, well, hey, if we make our separated bike lane wide enough, could not this fire truck right here on this slide use it, and that'd be a different way for emergency services to move around. And I've asked a few cyclists, and they've all said yes, they would move out of the separated bike lane if a truck like this is coming down it. And so, yeah, we've got a whole kind of way of working with emergency services that's different, but that's an important part of your project. Promotion was talked about. That's important for us, too, and so we've got the encourage, the educate, and the enforce, and this is all part of delivering a successful transportation plan and projects. And so right now we're on the next slide, it says promote walking and cycling as everyday options, and so we're very busy with our first active transportation promotion and enabling plan. We've had amazing interest from our stakeholders. I think we can't move fast enough in figuring out what is it that we're going to do in this. It's certainly for us at the city determining that we wouldn't be the lead role in all these things. So it's working with, you know, health partners. It's working with others, advocates, and others just keen on better built cities in terms of, you know, what's your role, what's our role, how do we kind of all row together. We've got on the educate side, the next slide, on the school side, we have an active safe routes to school program. We're actually working with 5 schools that have put their hand up and said we want to do more for our kids, our students, as well as the teachers, and we're offering them all sorts of tools and programs, and we'll do before and after data, and then we'll move on to the next set of schools that are keen and kind of progress through the 100-plus schools in Vancouver. And then the next slide, again, remembering safety as one of the target, you know, doing more to protect vulnerable road users. The photo is actually a slide of one of our bikeways. All our bikeways now are marked at 30 kilometers an hour. The default speed limit in Vancouver, otherwise for local streets, is 50 kilometers an hour. But it is a partnership with our Vancouver police because we do need some modest amount of enforcement on our bikeways at 30 kilometers an hour. We can't engineer each street to have every vehicle, for sure, work at that speed. So again, it comes down to all the partnerships. So in delivering the plan, consultation was mentioned, and we had record numbers of people participate in the plan, which is a great thing to fall back on now as we start rolling out the implementation. I remind people we had actually 2 phases. We had over 8,000 participants in the listening and learning stage, and then we had directions and discussion in over 10,000 participants. And again, council approved our plan in October last year, and we're in implementing stage. I should note that we have various, next slide says Active Transportation Policy Council. We have various advisory committees. We used to have a bicycle advisory committee, and pleased to report that that changed a few years ago, and this new advisory committee has actually a mandate to report out on vision, progress, policy for walking and cycling, and that includes kind of the promotion, and they've got 2 working subcommittees, one on promotion and partnerships and the other on projects. Very, very good group of people, great to work with, and really trying to help. And so that's kind of a value add for the city and Mayor and Council. So So some implementation principles on the next slide that we try and go through as we introduce new projects, new programs, and I think, again, emphasizing that, you know, we're learning as we go, even here in Vancouver. There isn't, you know, one formula, one manual. You know, there's a variety of ideas and thoughts, and kind of continue to innovate, monitor, learn, adapt, and take advantage of opportunities, but continue to work together. So the next slide, just on a walking perspective, just, you know, one example then of actually setting priorities, not trying to, for example, implement, you know, sidewalk width, which is a policy that we have, but giving it a higher priority for the downtown, giving it a higher priority for what's our future or our existing rapid transit areas. And then what would otherwise be largely single family neighborhoods, we don't really have that as a policy implementation that we're serious about, because it gives more opportunity for where more walking would be. Next slide then is showing you a cycling map. And it's worth mentioning that this was the one in October 2012 when the report was approved. But what we didn't do was didn't try and do a 30-year bike map. And this is important because when we had spoken with our businesses, and one of the frustrations that they had about the separated bike lanes being introduced was they didn't know really kind of where that came from. It wasn't sort of on any horizon. It really was taking painted bike lanes into separated bike lanes. And so what we said is we want to do a better job, and this kind of sort of fits their lens. Business perspectives have leases that expire, and usually those can be less than 5 years. So they said, please tell us, will you really plan on being in the next 5 years? So that's what we did. And then the next slide is showing you in June 2013, just a series of updates on that five-year map. And so we're going to try and be accountable in our bike month every year to update this and help people best know and be able to best plan, because some businesses will want to be attracted to, I think, what will be a street where we make walking and cycling investments. And other businesses will say, no thanks, but thanks for giving me a heads up. I've got a few years notice. I may want to relocate, and I'll be better suited on a street where you're not planning on doing a cycling improvement. So, can't emphasize enough on how important it is to work with all your transportation partners. I've mentioned a few of these. More and more so, I think we're also getting into design collaboration. The One City Studio is kind of a conglomerate of all of the kind of academia institutions within our Vancouver region, plus some others. And so that's just another way that I think that we're getting, again, walking and cycling into the dialogue and vocabulary of more people. And here we are. Excited. I've used this slide, the next one, working with health partners in a few presentations, and we're here because of CLASP and just showing you, I'm sure some of my health partners are also on the conference call, but more and more so brings me energy to work with our health partners. And then exciting for us in Vancouver is a healthy city strategy is being just started, officially launched before summer break. And so we've got a Green City Action Plan that kind of covers off the environment, and we've got an Economic Action Strategy that covers off the economy, and so remember that people part of our transportation plan. So this is a really good opportunity to engage our residents and community. And so this is, of course, the many building blocks that are kind of being looked at for Healthy City, but it's hard to see, but in the kind of upper left, there's one called Getting Around, there's another one called Being Active, and there's multiple ways that transportation planning engineers working with our team are working on the Healthy City strategy. I'm happy to be on the steering committee. I give them a bit of a fun jab and say I'm their token engineer on the steering committee, but it's great participating and working on, again, healthy citizens for Vancouver. So now I'm going to shift gears into what was, I guess, our case studies, a few active transportation corridor projects. So this one's called the Comox Homekin Greenway, and Stanley Park's one of our greatest assets, downtown large park, and then working towards Hornby Street, the separated bike lane. So the next slide shows you then really the downtown network of greenways and separated bike lanes, pink being the nice seawall for the most part, and the red being the separated bike lanes. Then the next slide in green, you'll see the Comox Greenway, and this is kind of the first phase of implementation from the large Stanley Park area up to the red, which would be Hornby Street. And then on the next slide, you can see that first thing we'll do is we'll kind of work towards making, you know, greater connections within Stanley Park to the left, and then within more of the downtown, what's called Yale Town in Vancouver. And one more slide gives you an idea of how this greenway already and in the future could connect to more schools, parks, community centers. And so it's a place for people to walk and cycle, but also kind of make more use of their community amenities. And we actually have a community plan process. And so again, working with land use planners at the same time about engaging residents about this new greenway. Now, the next slide is a project summary. Without kind of a laser pointer, it might be hard to explain, but I'm going to do my best. Maybe if you kind of look towards right at the middle of the greenway, there's two arrows indicating two one-way streets that actually kind of come together. And there's a big idea there, and that was that, again, remembering trying to reduce vehicle volumes, I said that we had some two-way streets become one-way streets. But then by actually having these two one-way streets come to this one street where then each of these cars needs to either go north or south, essentially it eliminated any shortcutting opportunity for the length of the greenway. And so that combined with, I'll have one photo of some separated bike lane conditions. Remember that graphic where I said, you know, doing enhanced crossings at arterials? This greenway is, we told council, is designed for all ages and abilities. But it isn't one formula, it's kind of a custom approach, block by block, crossing arterial by arterial, going by hospitals, going by hotels. And so we're just in the stages of actually getting some after data, and ultimately we'll report out on that. But what we're also doing is, and just again in terms of big takeaway for the large urban cities and our health partners, is working collaboratively and doing research partnerships with health partners. So one we're doing with UBC is so that's University of British Columbia, the Health and Community Design Lab, a full before-after study on trip patterns, but again, you know, helping me in my vocabulary, talking about social interactions, social connectedness. We have access to kind of the real data that I mentioned, but what about perception of safety? And then, of course, measuring some way the number and level of physical activity. And so we've got a radius kind of a kilometer in each direction of today's greenway and then the future. But we're not done there. We're also working with colleagues from the Center for Hip and Health and Mobility. And they're also working on the same study area of Comox Greenway, but now focused on older adults. And yet a lot of the same kinds of interactions, social interactions, how they're using the street, what hopefully some increased walking and cycling travel patterns along those corridors. And then together, both UBC and Center for Hip and Health, kind of working on school-aged children. There's a few schools, as I mentioned, along the Greenway. And so, you know, this kind of was mentioned, you know, building the business case. So right now, one of my efforts is kind of getting the corporate buy-in and getting, you know, more efforts to be able to do this, because it's one thing to look at a national study that says, yes, children will be, you know, better fit, more active if they walk or cycle more. It's another to be able to, for us, I think, to say yes. And in Vancouver, in our West End, or ultimately another community, we've got the evidence behind it. So just very quickly, again, just highlighting visuals. That's a one-way street on Comox with a counterflow bike facility. And then the next slide is showing you just another perspective. Senior cycling, got curb bulges. Some of our curb bulges, we've included, you know, stormwater management. There's a rain garden there at Comox at Nicola. Next slide, a raised crosswalk. And I actually think we can do better than this in terms of actually learning this. But we did have a big effort to have one side of the street, not both, as totally redone with curb ramps and sometimes raised crosswalks. Next slide is, again, that the kind of special treatments that we would do. This is a bit of a separated bike lane to get across a six-lane arterial along the Comox-Helmkin Greenway. Next slide is ultimately what it's about. This was a photo from one of our staff where we're actually seeing more ages, all ages, enjoying and making use of the greenway itself. So another bikeway project corridor that we took to council in June, got council approval, and are now building. The next slide shows you an investment that we made. It was kind of a spot improvement investment, public plaza, and carries about 3,000 to 4,000 bikes a day. It's hard to see, but in between the cyclists is a little bit of a blue half circle. That's actually a bike pump. So getting real about convenience and comfort. Cars have lots of opportunity to fill their tires at our on arterials with gas stations, so we wanted to increase the comfort and convenience for cycling by having a few bike pumps. So on the ADNAC bikeway, the next slide gives you a perspective of what it used to be, very busy bikeway, but also very busy with cars. That the next one also says ADNAC bikeway, this time Union Street, east of Main. One of our first bike boxes was red. Everything now in Vancouver is green paint. But giving you an idea, even in those efforts, that's all ultimately not that comfortable for too many cycling people. And then this is kind of what it's looking like now. So it's Carroll Street Connection, the next slide. What you see is actually a two-way separated bike lane. And we're not using the landscaping in this case, like the Hornby Street downtown. We're trying to find ways that are lower on the maintenance costs, but still delivering safe and comfortable cycling. The next slide, just giving you again an example of sort of some custom design thinking, particular to the street configuration that we have, using green paint again to highlight conflict zones where cars and bikes would still mix. Next slide, just showing you again some more separation, but in this time, just using those easy to put down concrete barriers, because in this case, we've got a large study underway where some of the viaduct infrastructure may come down in terms of our city building in years to come. And then the next slide, this one particular block of the project took about 6 hours at council. And so I just want to also make sure, sometimes we get calls, oh, it must be easy in Vancouver and you've got a bike-friendly mayor. Well, it's not. This block here, the next slide, highlighted in red, we had proposed in that direction to actually have one large cycle track. We got a lot of pushback from the businesses, which we had consulted with some adjacent residents, and ultimately we had recommended to council on the next slide a shared lane. And again, this is the being willing as health partners to support your engineers and planners when they are giving advice to say, well, you know, but incrementally this is kind of the best place to land and to give advice to our mayor and council. And ultimately, you know, still doing things like plastic bollards to make sure that, you know, bikes aren't being passed by fast-moving cars. But I have full confidence that this will be successful to begin with, but also that in 5 years from now, we'll have a lot of public pressure, not just from people who cycle, but could you kind of go back to that original idea of a separated bike lane? But, you know, finding that right landing spot. Construction opportunities was mentioned, and so this was a really exciting one for us, Richard Street upgrades. It is a painted bike lane right now, and in this photo here, on the far right, you would see a sidewalk with curbside parking and then a bike lane. And so on the next slide, just the red circle highlights that for you. And so the big idea here was we were going to reverse the parking and put the bike lane next to the curb, and again, at no cost other than the repaving cost that was already there as part of our street rehab budget. And so the next slide with the red circle shows how we flipped it around, and so now you've got these nice big metal objects called cars that are parked that are buffering you, the hopefully new and interested cyclist, away from cars, generally speaking, for most of the block. So the next slide shows you kind of the condition of the painted bike lane. One of my colleagues in engineering, a utility colleague, obviously forgot to paint the repaint the other half of our bike lane. But nonetheless, here's kind of what it would look like. You'd have a condition where you'd often be as many bike lanes, you know, in the possibility of a door opening in the door zone. And then kind of giving you an idea, well, I'm really comfortable in the bike lane so much that when there aren't cars, you can see the cyclists here shying away from even using the painted bike lane. Next slide showing you, of course, trucks move along these arterials as well. So if you had been a cyclist at that time, you could just imagine your comfort level. So then you get to the next slide and you see what's just recently been painted. And so we did work on narrowing each of the travel lanes such that we could create this painted buffer. And remembering, of course, there's still a possible dooring, but now you're only dealing with passengers, not drivers. Every car is going to have a driver, but not always a passenger. And so again, just for the cost that was going to happen anyways for repaving the street, this is one of the ways that we're trying to increase comfort and safety of cycling. This is what it used to be in terms of the intersection conflict at Richards and Smythe for a through-moving cyclist with a right-turning yellow cab and through-moving cars. And so what we did is, you know, it was quickly noted, but, you know, there's bikeway guidelines for Ontario. NACTO is another one. So spent a lot of time as a team. Did we want to kind of do this type of treatment, this conceptual with a dedicated right turn and green paint to highlight the conflict zones? Ultimately, the next slide shows you what we decided. We decided to keep the buffered bike lane and then have a condition where it would be mandatory for cars to yield to bikes and then use the green paint across the intersection where ultimately the car needs to yield to the bike. And so what that looks like is this, but you can see much of a shared environment where the cars are, you know, hopefully always looking to and watching out for cyclists. But ultimately, if we need to, we could add bike signals here, make that into a randator or phasing in a right turn vehicle separate from vehicles, sorry, bikes. But at this point in time, the green paint and the configuration we're quite pleased with. Almost finished, but just trying to get through a couple of other recent examples. Canby Bridge, photo here of what is a very good large east shared path across the Canby Bridge. And then the next slide, though, shows you when you get to the north end how you've got this very tight space where you've got a bus shelter, you've got walking and cycling actually all using that same space. And there's an example of that same bus shelter where a cyclist is making use of it next to moving cars. And then the next slide, again, how does a cyclist and the pedestrians get across the next arterial? And then the next slide giving you actually what happened a lot of times, even with a painted bike lane, people just ended up using this really wide sidewalk. So graphically speaking, that large sidewalk that you use, just we reallocated into being still a very good sidewalk for pedestrians, but then introducing a separated bike lane as well. And sorry, I just have to click your slides a couple times to kind of show you the then crossing Expo Boulevard. And then click again until you see a slide that says bus shelter removal. So that's the bus shelter now removed. So we've gained space by, we're going to move that bus shelter to the far side of the intersection, which is more typical for transit anyways, and just exciting for us to see, you know, now the separated bike lane under construction. And I am going to, in the benefit of time, flip through these slides really quickly. And so we still have a few times for questions. But this is a huge project that could be 20 minutes in itself. But if you flip all the way to the end, 147 out of 150, I just put in a couple of slides on front covers of our newspapers. Again, just to make sure you're thinking, oh, again, is it easy in Vancouver? No, it's not. We're constantly having to take the temperature politically, media, making sure we're, again, getting data to show that the investments that are being made are actually increasing walking and cycling. And then, but some go to slide 149, some great outside sourcing media polling where, you know, having a separated bike lane increases safety and comfort for cyclists. 83% agree or strongly agree. And then to our health practitioners, bike lanes provide more opportunities for people to be physically active, 75%. So this is kind of really good news for us in Vancouver in terms of some of the things that have happened lately and how things are shaping up to be. And that is it.
Thank you very much, Dale. This is Kim. I'm going to open the lines. I just want to say to people, when I open the lines, because there can be a lot of background noise with so many people, can I please ask you to hit *4 to mute your phone unless you're going to ask a question. If you're going to ask a question, can you please just introduce yourselves first? Just say who you are. And we only have probably 5 minutes for questions, but maybe Dale and Dave, are you able to stay for an extra 5 or 10 minutes if we continue on?
Yeah, that works for us.
And Dale, does that work for you if we have an extra 5 or 10 minutes?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay, so for people who would like to stay for an extra 5 or 10 minutes, that works for Dale and Dave. And so I'm going to unmute the phone. And then the other thing I'd just say is, as Murphy's Law would have it, the cable company showed up and have disconnected my internet up front. So I'm going to ask anybody who wants to send questions by email to send them to Jean Chin at gchin@hsf.ca, and Jean can pop in if we've got time to get to those. So I'm just going to unmute the phones now.
The conference is now in talk mode.
Okay, so any questions? It's quite a bit of information, some fabulous visuals. I hope that most of you could see them. So any questions from people?
John Forci here. In Vancouver, the traffic circles and roundabouts, interaction between bikes and cars on them, is it... I'm not sure. They've become a fashionable thing in planning, but I don't know whether they're any better than lights or signs.
Dale, do you want to give that a try, or Dave?
Have you ever heard of the Blackberry Glen Bed and Breakfast on Salt Trail?
Hi, folks. Can I just ask you to mute your phone with *4 if you're having some background noise in your office, please?
Can I check with your lady friend? Yeah, she just sent it to me and said they want to stay here.
You should.
Well, I'll try and answer the question. We still use traffic circles along our bikeways, but we're also not using them as much. And then we're also doing a cycling safety study right now just to review the collision history of traffic circles in general.
I can recommend a place on Bowen. That's where we got engaged.
Oh, you got
engaged
on Bowen?
I'm not getting engaged.
Hubby, I'll hit *5 so you can answer the question. Okay, Dale? Hang on.
The conference is now in silent mode.
Okay. Want to give that a try now?
Sure. We will continue to use traffic circles on bikeways. However, we're doing a cycling safety study that's reviewing, you know, whether there's particular locations, I guess you'd say, that we've had sort of a higher collision history. In fact, we removed one traffic circle on a bikeway lately. So for us, we think it's at times the right tool, but being prudent and thinking about what other might be some other engineering measures along bikeways that achieve the same calming or vehicle reduction effect.
And Dave, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think Dale's got it right. You know, it really is a location-specific issue that, you know, traffic circles can be a little challenging for cyclists and pedestrians depending on the volume of traffic and how it's designed. So, you know, we here at MMM are pretty careful about the kind of, you know, location that one is proposed at, and very often multi-use trails along some of the roads where we have traffic circles are more common, but we do have on-road bike facilities, and depending on how many lanes in the circle and how it's designed and the location, it's something that has to be assessed. So I think the jury's still out on traffic circles for cyclists and pedestrians, but again, thinking about complete streets, cyclists not to stop either, just like cars, and that's one of the great benefits of traffic circles. So it's really, can you design it so everyone is comfortable and understands how it's supposed to operate?
Okay, and Jean, do you have any questions for us from people?
I do. This one is from Francois Gagnon at the NCCHPP. Why does the DOT keep some of the car lanes at 3.4 meters? Also, does the Act of Transportation take special interest in road security in the downtown east side? Are there plans to expand the cycle network through road diets in Vancouver?
So that's two different questions, Jean?
Three.
Okay. Why don't we start with the first one?
Why does the DOT keep some of the car lanes at 3.4 meters?
And Dave or Dale, do either of you want to try that one?
I think that's for you, Dave.
So, sorry, I thought it was from Vancouver. Ask the question one more time.
Why does the DOT keep some of the car lanes at 3.4 meters?
I'm not sure. 3.4 meters. Are we talking about a particular road? I mean, looking at travel lane widths for on roads, we, depending on the location, can vary from 3.75 down to 3.25. Even down to 3 in certain roads where we've got really low speed. So
Again, it's contact sensitive. I think there's some opportunity depending on the location and you know, the purpose of the road and thinking about built form and what's happening on that road. It really dictates the width of the street and in particular the width of the travel lanes. Is there on-street parking? Is there a lot of turnover? What's happening? So I don't know, Dale, do you have anything to add on that?
No, I don't. Same thing for us. I mean, it's always, is it, for example, a street that moves transit buses? Is it a truck route? We will go down to 3-meter travel lanes, but those are then still streets that are tend not to be bus routes or truck routes. So it does depend on the context of the street that you're designing.
And Jean, what was the second question?
The second question, specifically for the City of Vancouver, does the Active Transportation take special interest in road security in the downtown east side?
Yes. We, in fact, on Hastings Street, one of the main arterials, we have created a 30-kilometer-hour zone for, I think, 4 to 6 blocks. And we actually have installed an additional pedestrian signal where, you know, jaywalking is not something that we encourage, but it was happening across quite a long stretch within the downtown east side. So we installed a special pedestrian bike signal. So we have taken, other measures that improve pedestrian and cycling safety for the downtown east side.
And Jean, was there a third one?
The third question from Francois, the third and last one. Are there plans to expand the cycle network through road diets in Vancouver?
Well, no, not as a policy in terms of we will, but of course, within a constrained urban environment, sometimes the way that you will be able to expand your bike network will have to be road space reallocation. So we've made that clear in Transportation 2040, but again, it's not a war or an attack on the car, and we want to be conscious of if we need to do that, how do we work with those that are driving vehicles, loading and being conscious of that. But of course, yes, that sometimes it is going to be a road diet to make more space for walking and cycling.
Okay, and I'm going to reopen. I'm going to unmute the phones again. So if I could just ask everybody on the phone, if you're not asking a question, perhaps you could hit *4 to mute your phones because there was quite a bit of background noise last time. So again, here I go.
The conference is now in talk mode.
So again, are there some questions in, for Dale or for Dave?
Hi, Kim. It's Jean here again. I've got one more question for you.
Okay.
From Richard Gould at Paul District Health Authority in Nova Scotia. And this is for the City of Vancouver. Could you provide some more information on how the evaluation information about active transportation patterns and attitudes at baseline and over time was collected? And a second question from Richard. Special surveys done, or was there some source of existing information?
And again, Dale, I'm going to mute the phones for you just so we can hear well, okay?
Yeah.
The conference is now in silent mode.
Okay, Dale?
Yeah. we don't have the report done because the Greenway itself just was completed June, July this year. So our health partners have done their before data. We haven't gotten together and talked about what that's saying. But ultimately, I think the interest is in will Vancouver ultimately show those studies and show the results? Absolutely. So what we'll do, though, first is when we do these types of research partnerships, we'll report first to our mayor and council because ultimately it's city funding that has done this. But totally, we're open to sharing. We want to be able to share that across Canada, or whoever, will have a PDF eventually available for all to peruse and hopefully benefit from beyond Vancouver.
And Jean, was there a second question in there?
Well, it was all about the same thing. Were special surveys done, or was there some source of existing information?
And Dale, do you want to add anything to that? I think
So there were two special surveys done by the two health partners. Like I said, one was an overall kind of travel survey that was done. It's very much like a trip diary, 24-hour with other questions added to it. And then the other one was much more of a targeted research with our colleagues from Center for Hip for Health for seniors within the West End of Vancouver. But both are new and different surveys that were done for that Greenway.
Thank you. And I'm going to unmute one more time here.
The conference
again,
is
any
now
last questions?
Mode.
And if people could just watch the background noise, please. Any more questions for Dale or Dave? I think we're going to call it quits. But so Dale and Dave, I just want to thank you and also Jay and Claire. The four of you have done an excellent job. I think that the information is really helpful to all of us. Thank you very much for taking the time to do this today. And thank you for all of you who attended and participated today. So I think at that we'll let you go, but thank you once again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.